He is an associate prof at the Red Path Museum and McGill School of the Environment, as most of you know. He is, I would say, thought of broadly as one of Canada's top two invading species researchers working on aquatic ecosystems. He's published, to justify that, over 80 papers in the peer-reviewed literature. He's a much-valued colleague. Every time I work with Tony on something, I'm very excited by the products. He's on the Program Organizing Committee of the Canadian Aquatic Invading Species Invasive Network, and much sought after by CPC and other media outlets when they want comments on invading species. His talk today addresses the question of why biological invasion should be considered as an environmental stressor for the future of major concern. Dr. Ricciardi.
Thanks, Storm. Now, biosecurity, just to start off with the definition, refers to the management of organisms that are deemed to pose a threat to society. Now, as you probably know, to North Americans, this doesn't mean the exact same thing as it does to the rest of the world. North Americans tend to place a more of a terrorist aspect to this word. The rest of the world, especially Europe, South Africa, New Zealand, Australia, they refer to biosecurity as the management of organisms such as invasive species and pathogens that threaten natural resources and people. And they take it very seriously. In New Zealand, for example, in both New Zealand and Australia, those governments have departments of biosecurity. New Zealand has a Biosecurity Act. It has a strategy for improving biosecurity science. They take this quite seriously. I wish I could point to something in Canada that's similar. I can't. So what I'm going to talk about today is why we should take this. We should approach biosecurity, especially with respect to invasive species, with the same kind of seriousness. Now, you cannot open up a newspaper, it seems, without running into an article that involves what I call alien species. Well, you've probably heard of the emerald ash borer. It's in Quebec now, has been for a couple of years. It is a serious pest of ash trees. Basically, there's no cure for the ash tree when it has these things in it. It will kill the ash tree. I'll talk more about the implication of that later. It's one of several beetles that have invaded Canada. In the coastal waters, you'll hear about Asian invaders and European invaders and all kinds of other ones on both coasts. Most latest one is an invasive seaweed that was reported a few months ago. Lake Erie and the rest of the Great Lakes continue to be threatened by invasions. More recently, there were these diamondback moths that are spreading through BC that threaten certain agricultural industries. All of these, and I could go on, but these are not isolated monster stories. These are all symptoms of a larger global phenomenon, which I'm going to describe so I can put into context what Canada's facing. And then I'll get into the specifics with respect to Canada. I'm referring to, I talk about alien species or non-indigenous or non-native. These are all the same thing. They refer to species that have been introduced into regions beyond their historical range, beyond the range in which they evolved, usually by people. Although species have been moving around throughout the history of life, what's happening now has no precedent in the fossil record. Species are moving faster and farther than ever before under human influence. So this constitutes a unique form of global change, I would argue. Now, the process we're talking about is called biological invasion, and that refers to the spread and establishment of a species into a region beyond its natural range. E.O. Wilson, the famous naturalist, described this as the least understood yet among the most sinister of processes now altering the living environment. Some of these species have been here quite a long time. You might not recognize them as non-native. The European earwig, for example. You might recognize the Asian gypsy moth larva or purple loosestrife or European starlings that have been here for over a century. We are receiving species a lot faster now, and many of them are more recognizable as being alien. They're quite different from what we already have. Norm referred to a couple of them. Here are more of them. These ones, for example, come from the Black Sea, or more specifically, the freshwater margins of the Black Sea. You may have heard of some of these, the zebra mussel, of course, its cousin, the quagga mussel, which followed soon afterwards, the round goby, which... Is it on? Hello. Okay, it is now. The round goby, for those of you who do any fishing in the St. Lawrence River, you're going to encounter this a lot because it's one of the most abundant bottom-dwelling fishes in the St. Lawrence River and the Great Lakes. This is the This is a new invader, one of the last one, actually, to come into the Great Lakes, and it's all over the St. Lawrence River now. It's called the Bloody Red Micet. It's a shrimp. And we have other things that don't have common names, except for this one, which is the fishhook water flea, yet another planktonic predator that has come over from Eurasia. Now, my point here is that all of these species made a large jump to get to the Great Lakes. They had to cross the Atlantic Ocean. There is no natural mechanism by which any of them could have made could have performed this dispersal on their own without human assistance. And this is characterizing what's happening in the world, these large jumps. Now, we sent species over on the other side. This species is a comb jellyfish, and it's common around the mid-Atlantic coast. It's a predator, and it was brought over in ships to the Black Sea. Actually, it arrived before the Z-mussel came from the other direction. And it being a voracious predator and reproducing very rapidly, it feeds on zooplankton, which is what this fish feeds on, and it feeds on, it also feeds on fish larvae and eggs that happen to be buoyant in the plankton, including its larvae and eggs. And so it provided both competition and predation to the Black Sea anchovy, a commercially important fish in the region, which serves multiple countries, and the Black Sea anchovy crashed. These are orders of magnitude differences along this bar. This was an economic disaster in the area as a result of this invader from North America. So species are jumping across the planet. We've got something like 35 European mammals that have become established in New Zealand. There's no way any of them could have gotten there on their own. We've got species in the Antarctic now. The Antarctic has something like 200 non-native species in the coastal waters and in the ice-free regions along the peninsula and in the islands around the Antarctic. Species are making big jumps. They're also moving faster than ever before. Here are the prehistoric rates of invasion inferred from the appearance of species in multiple places, from the Galapagos to the Black Sea. And you could see, for example, for Hawaii, there would be maybe one new species becoming established every 30,000 years or so. Then the Polynesians came, and that bumped up a little, quite a lot, actually. And then Hawaii became expanded as a major port, both as an airport and seaports. And so now what you see is orders of magnitude difference in the modernist invasion rate. Hawaii receives 20 new species that become established per year. That's one every 3 weeks, which is 800,000 times faster than what the natural rate was. This is, again, the human signature. Species moving farther and faster than ever before. So although species have always moved around before, what we're seeing now is an unprecedented form of human-driven global change. And the reasons for it is because we have transportation systems that move species very quickly around the planet. One of them is shipping, which carries most of our trade. 80-90% of trade is carried by ships. So as trade expands, shipping traffic expands. These ships, the legal ones, carry transponders, and you could see that we've created this superstructure lattice network connection that connects major parts of the world. A single ship, 14 months activity. This is what a single ship does in 14 months. Visits multiple ports around the world carrying ballast water. I'll talk more about that later. Taking it on, ballast water, removing it, and so on. Ballast water is what ships use to keep themselves weighted with enough weight in the water so that they don't bob like a cork. And they reduce it when they take on cargo and fill it up again when they remove cargo. Now, Canada receives about 50 billion liters of ballast water from these ships. Here's some emptying its tanks annually. 50 billion liters. What's in the ballast water? Well, it's been sampled many times. 1 liter typically contains hundreds of zooplankton, thousands of phytoplankton, millions of bacterial cells, and billions of virus particles. This is what's being carried in the ballast water being moved around by ships. It's been estimated that over 5,000 species are in motion around the world in ship ballast tanks at any given time. This is a major, remarkable, unprecedented dispersal vector. Of course, ships are also carrying things attached to their hulls. You could look at barnacles, and you could look at sponges, and you could look at things, sea squirts called tunicates, which are also a pest on the East Coast as well and are becoming more and more common, mussel colonies and so on. Ships are basically floating islands with I call them floating syringes, actually, because of what they're carrying in them. So ships are carrying whole communities, little mini ecosystems around the world to inoculate ports with, and they are responsible for hundreds of documented invasions. Now, there's enormous numbers of organisms being moved not only by ships, but also through live trade. And this is something that's emerging as a very important vector, has been and now being recognized as such, and only increasing in importance. So if you look at just fishes being important to the U.S. for various reasons, for either aquaculture or for the ornamental pet trade, for example, or whatever reason, 1.1 billion live fishes were imported to the U.S. over this five-year span. All right, cargo planes carrying the live fishes and so on. Canada is more or less the same. U.S. is drowning in fishes. All right, some of them are quite photogenic. This one is, I'll talk more about this one. This is the northern snakehead fish, which some of you may have heard of, because it was one of these was caught in Burnaby Lake in B.C. last summer. Along with this cargo, and I was talking about the intended cargo, are hitchhikers, unintended passengers, and they get into untreated wood pallets and dunnage, and the beetles are especially noted for this because their larvae can bore into the wood. And so untreated wood will often carry some beetles in it or other things like wasps and so on. And here is a pupa of a beetle. It's this one, the Asian longhorn beetle, which now infests a few Canadian cities. And those of you from Toronto, for example, will have seen for a long time now signs that warn you not to move your firewood or untreated wood around because you have these around. If these ever get well established in Vermont, Quebec, that part of Canada, northeastern United States, they attack hardwood trees, and they would be a very serious threat to the maple sugar industry. Now, we know there are many graphs I could show you. I won't. But many graphs I could show you that link invasions or discovery of invaders with trade. This is just one of them that we're talking about that was looking at alien spiders, relatives of the black widow, which, of course, some people are concerned about suddenly finding amongst their cargo, being delivered around the world, especially in this case into Europe, right? Increasing delivery of these things correlated with products that are being delivered from various parts of the world where they exist. Now, I'm going to make a series of propositions and relate it to Canada, more or less. And the first proposition I'll say, I'm not making these lightly. I'm basing this on a burgeoning literature that's well established, and that is ecosystem services and natural resources are threatened by some invasions. A lot of invasions don't threaten them at all. Some of the ones that we plan can be beneficial to some stakeholders, not to necessarily all of them. Many unplanned invasions can have all kinds of effects that are unpredictable, and a small proportion of them have devastating effects, and the fact that it's a small fraction is not something that I would find comfortable, given that we've increased the total number of species moving around anyway. And I would say invasions are capable of eroding ecosystem services and threatening natural resources. Start with biodiversity. In all cases of where we have long-term data, especially for islands and lakes and river basins and even parts of continents, we have examples where invasions have contributed to modern animal extinctions, often significantly. Over half the cases of global animal extinctions, especially including global fish extinctions, mammal extinctions, and bird extinctions. And by the way, even if they don't cause extinctions, they are also responsible for population declines. And that's something that doesn't get into these databases, because if a native species is just hanging on after being reduced through predation, for example, or an exchange of parasites or so on, it will still be counted in a simple inventory as having been present, and so that impact may be lost. Paul Ehrlich noted that most species have a couple of hundred populations that are genetically distinct, and we're losing those. It's like losing books in a library. If the library is still standing, but there's hardly anything on its shelves, that's how it would be counted in a simple inventory without taking into account the population diversity that's been eroded. And invasions do erode that as well. If you look at freshwater fish that are at risk, a study that was done a few years ago noted that one of the two major drivers of extinction for those species are habitat alteration and invasions by alien species. Ecosystem services, forest productivity. The emerald ash borer beetle, which was introduced into North America, it was discovered in 2002. Interesting story about that. It got in through infected, contaminated wood dunnage from packing crates from China. This was at the time, we've already recognized that this was a dangerous pathway, because it already brought in the Asian longhorn beetle. It could have brought in, it has brought in, the Asian gypsy moth and a variety of other things that were on the radar. So the United States and Canada imposed a trade ban on all untreated wood lumber coming from China from the Asian region. This got in before that was properly enforced. It was discovered in Detroit in 2002 and started to spread through Ontario and subsequently into Quebec, and it will continue to spread, and it kills ash trees, and it's killed over 20 billion, tens of millions of them already, maybe 50 million of them. And therefore, it could change, it could reduce a forest, it could affect the productivity of a forest very quickly. It could, because the fact is there's no cure or hardly any treatment for this once the trees have been infested by ash borer. And it's estimated that, well, it's basically a modern-day plague. And ash forests around North America are at risk of this. Other examples, moving out of forests into the honeybee industry. Honeybees are an example of a species that's alien that we brought over North America and is useful. And for every non-native species that you point out that's useful, I could find other ones that are harming it and removing the advantage that we get from them. And this is, varroa mites are among those. Varroa mites are native to Asian honeybees, and at some point the hives got mixed such that the mites were allowed to jump hosts onto European honeybees who have no immunity, no experience, no adaptive immunity to these parasites, and so the hives die very quickly. It was discovered, it's been moving around the world, discovered in Brazil, in Europe, North America, the UK, and so on, continues to move, and they are one more threat, one more a cause of the loss of wild honeybee populations. And we could spend a lot of time talking about what the implications of that is for pollination. Something else that may not be well known yet to the public, but soon will be as it grows in prominence, is that bats are dying in eastern North America as a result of a fungus that is from Europe. We don't know how it got brought over here, but probably through some human mechanism. And since 2006, millions of bats have been killed by it. And it's called white nose syndrome because the fungus expresses itself, seeing this white patches on the face of the bat, which dies. And this is going to have an economic impact on agriculture because these bats, a single colony of these bats, for example, can eat nearly 1.3 million pest insects each year. What happens when those bats are gone? So this is a major biotic constraint, a checks and balances. Part of the checks and balances you have in ecology is these specialized predators that feed on these insects, and now they're being removed, a large scale. So we can expect there will be an indirect effect on agriculture. There's going to be an ecosystem service that's been lost now because of this. An emerging biosecurity threat that most of you may not have heard of, but you're going to in the future. And that is a wheat-killing fungus. It's native to East Africa. It's dispersed by spores, and the major point is it destroys entire wheat fields. So this is a threat to food security, a global threat, so much so that Canada's involved in doing something about it. Right? So precisely, that's how serious it is. We are contributing to a global study to try to rapidly rush against time to figure out how to develop wheat that can resist this fungus which kills it. There's a lot at risk. So I could go on, but I wanted to give you a taste of what's moving around. New health risks associated with invasive species will occur. West Nile virus is not a huge risk. What's important, except for those who don't have any immunity to it, what's important is where it came from and how fast it spread. No, very few people ever heard of this virus before 1999, when it appeared in New York City. It was one of those viruses, one of many, that was sitting in the heart of Africa and most people haven't heard of. And then it appeared in New York City, probably being brought in through by illegal pet trade of birds, and spread very quickly through the crow and jay population. It's been moving around, rapidly spread across the continent. It's been found in multiple provinces in Canada, not in BC yet, mostly in Quebec and Ontario. Human cases, it's been found in birds across Canada. Human cases have been found mostly in Quebec and Ontario. I imagine we've underestimated that caseload because of how difficult it is, at least in the beginning, to recognize it. That's an example of how, just to remind us that the ocean is no longer a suitable barrier to keep things out like this. The Asian tiger mosquito is one of several vectors of disease that are going through expansion right now that's probably driven largely by climate change because they're moving northward. And so they're not in Canada yet, but they're in most of the United States. I think it's a matter of time before they get to Canada. And the reason we care is because how fast they're spreading and because they can vector over 20 different human viruses that are pathogenic, including things that aren't here yet, such as Japanese encephalitis. So it's closing the loop for something like Japanese encephalitis to become established in Canada. And one of the reasons things like pathogens, which also count as invasive species, are being spread around, of course, is the movement of people. And we've created this massive network by which you've heard, those of you who know about Marshall McLuhan, remember him talking about the global village, and he was talking about the world being smaller, effectively, because it's so well connected by the transfer of information very quickly through technology. And he was saying that before the internet, and he was right. But I argue we're living in a biological global village where pathogens, organisms in general, are moving around very quickly, and we can no longer assume that if something's in Africa, we don't have to worry about it. And this is why. SARS made that quite clear, actually. Something in Hong Kong and a few months later appearing in Toronto. We're seeing, in terms of multiple effects, the symptoms of multiple effects, we're seeing global increase in paralytic shellfish poisoning, or at least it appears that way. Now, paralytic shellfish poisoning is where you have toxins released from blooms of algae, like toxic dinoflagellates, so large that they get into the food supply through filter feeders like oysters and mussels filtering them. Now, there could be a reason, among the reasons why we're seeing this, could be because we're getting better at detecting it. It could be because oceans are warmer, especially along the coast, and that could be stimulating microbial growth, stimulating the growth of dinoflagellates. That's probable, too. Increased domestic sewage in some parts of the world, stimulating blooms. And another reason, you don't have this happening unless the species are there. They're getting moved around in ships because they form cysts that can remain for a long time in the inhospitable climate of a ballast tank until they get stirred up and spit out somewhere around the world. And we know this because people have sampled ballast tanks and have found these to be common in them, including the ones like Alexandrium and so on that cause these toxic blooms. So here we have an example of the influence of probably multiple causes, including invasion pathways. Ecological and technological systems will be disrupted by invasive species in unpredictable ways. I'll give you one example. There's many, but I'll give you one example. There's something going on, something very disturbing going on in the Great Lakes. Well, many things disturbing going on in the Great Lakes, but one of them is that 200,000 birds, at least, have been killed since 1999, every year since 1999. These are all fish-eating waterfowl, loons, mergansers, gulls, that sort of thing. You see large carcasses washing up on shore. Of course, that affects cottage values, and it makes people scared when they see carcasses, something like that, especially since the birds are dying by drowning. This is waterfowl, okay? Because they have a neurotoxin in them. And some fish are dying, too. People are more used to seeing that than this. What's been isolated is a form of a rare strain of botulism. So, produced by botulinum bacteria, Clostridium botulinum, a strain of it. And we don't know if that botulinum bacteria in the Great Lakes, which lives in the sediments, is an alien or native. We have no idea, and we never will know. It could have been brought in ballast tanks, or it may always been here. But it can only thrive when there is anoxic conditions, low oxygen. So how is it getting that? Because you can't get all of this happening unless the botulinum bacteria is thriving. And so there are anoxic zones, like there used to be in the 60s when we had eutrophication problems. There are anoxic zones coming in again, but not because of eutrophication per se, or at least not because of nutrient loading. Because there appears to be great biological activity, well, not appears to be, there is great biological activity being driven by zebra and quagga mussels, these filter feeders. Why? Because the filter feeders clear the water. They don't clean it any more than sweeping your dirt under the rug cleans your house. They clear it, okay? They move it from the open water to the bottom. And that makes the water transparent, and that increases light, and that switches. So you switch on the lights in an area where macrophytes might be light limited. And so plants start to grow like mad, especially the invasive ones who take advantage of these opportunities. And so you get massive growth of attached algae and weeds. It has to die at some point. It all dies en masse near the end of the summer. And when it does, the decomposition will put a great strain on oxygen in the water. That's biological oxygen demand. And that's what's creating these anoxic zones, according to what we're thinking. And so the zebra and quagga mussels are facilitating this bacterium. It exists as spores, and under these conditions, they can germinate. Now, the mussels, being close proximity to the sediments, filter the spores, so they have the bacterium and the toxin in them. Now, that's fine if nothing eats the mussels, and not much does, or at least not until recently. Because we have this species here, the round goby, here it is eating mussels, which is the natural predator of the zebra and quagga mussel in the Black Sea, and it came over too. Now, just because there's a predator there doesn't mean it controls the presence of a predator doesn't control the prey necessarily. But there's plenty of prey, they reproduce very quickly, and so the round gobies have plenty to feed on. It's probably one of the things that contributed to their success because they didn't have much competitors for this food. Now, they're the most abundant bottom-dwelling fish now. So they're the most abundant prey for things like this, for loons. So this is being generated by zebra mussel activity. They're filtering it. They have the toxin in the tissues. We know that. The round gobies, 80% of their diet are mussels when they're older. They're getting the toxin. You open up a round goby, you'll get toxin, and you'll see the zebra mussels in there. And if you open up the stomach of a loon that's died, you're going to see round gobies in it. So what's happening is that the goby has acted like a link between the mussels and the fish, fish-eating birds, excuse me, that allows the transfer of this toxin, which otherwise wouldn't have occurred. You have a couple of invaders that are interacting here. We can explain it, we're still not certain, but we can explain it after the fact. But post-hoc explanation is not prediction. This could not have been predicted from anything we knew from Europe, for example. This is a complete surprise. More to the point, they didn't just stop there. The quagga mussels in particular, which are very efficient filter feeders, who are fighting a war for space with the zebra mussels in the St. Lawrence and Great Lakes, and they're winning, because of what their activities, increasing light and so on, are producing a lot of facilitating filamentous algae, which breaks off and floats downstream. It surfaces and floats downstream and clogs intake pipes. And it happened that so much of it that they clogged the cooling systems of a nuclear power plant in 2007 and forced an emergency shutdown three times. Emergency meaning the alarms go off, this is a big deal. So three times, and it's happened since then. But that summer was a bad one, right? Because a lot of this was produced because of the activity of the mussels and because of warm temperatures. So nuclear power plants were interfered with and disrupted. Their emergency cooling systems were disrupted by the activities of the mussels. Who could have predicted that? We can explain it and understand it now. We couldn't have predicted. There's more, but you get the idea. Climate change will promote new invasions by altering the vulnerability of Canada's landscape. Boris and Norm refer to what's happening in the north. Boris, in particular, pointed out that the ice-free seasons are getting more common. The sea ice extent is declining. This is opening up shipping lanes that never existed before and keeping them open longer. Northwest Passage being very, very, and other side routes are being open now, permitting. We can predict. We're going to predict what will happen in the future. We can predict places like Churchill, Manitoba, Deception Bay, and so on will become far more busy than they are now. And they'll be open up to the world looking for new trade routes. And that means more ships, and that means more inoculations. And as the context is changing, some warm water species or less cold tolerant species will suddenly be able to establish in these areas. The Arctic and the Antarctic are no longer remote and pristine in this globalized world. A case study for Laurentian Great Lakes, which I've studied. Great Lakes are a major recipient system of ships. They've been disturbed in many ways. Over 187 species that we know of have been established. Alien species have been established in Great Lakes. Since 1960, one new invader found every 7 months. These are the ones that cause the most trouble that we know about. There's probably other ones that we don't know about, most of these haven't been studied very well. But we've got a lot of pathogens appearing, musky pox, so on. I'd say one in four invaders since 1980 is a high-impact, highly disruptive species. Now, we did something about this, finally. We recognize that ships are the biggest, they account for 60% of the invasion of the Great Lakes, especially since the opening of the seaway. So if we can control that, we can do a lot to reduce the problem in the Great Lakes. And so the first thing we tried was ballast water regulation 1993, which didn't change much. I'm not going to get into the details, but there was a loophole in that most ships were not covered by that regulation. And furthermore, it wasn't very effective even when it was applied. They closed the loophole in 2006 using a better technology. It's being enforced, and we haven't had a single invasion, shipborne invasion, since 2006. That's the largest period of time without having an invasion recorded in the Great Lakes. Now, it could be that this is 100% effective. I doubt it, but it's probably quite effective, and this is a success story. The only invader that's come in, well, the last invader to come in was that mysid, the freshwater mysid shrimp, the bloody red mysid I showed you. Another one, the last one from the Pano Caspian, from the Black Sea region. And ever since then, nothing. That doesn't mean there are not other vectors at risk working, and one of them is live trade, because that one remains unregulated. Lots of species being moved around. The ones you'd heard of probably are the Asian carps. Here they are. The grass carp, which has been here a long time, big head and silver, which are brought over to North America to control plankton and catfish ponds, and escaped during the floods, especially the ones in the early 90s, got in the Mississippi River, out of the reservoirs they're kept in, got in the Mississippi River Basin, spread, did very well, and now are knocking at the door of the Great Lakes threatening to enter through the Chicago Shipping Canal, which was an artificial connection between Lake Michigan and the upper Mississippi River. So, this was recognized, so the Army Corps of Engineers put in an electric barrier to try to keep the carp out. It seemed to have worked for a long time. I'll talk about that in a second. But meanwhile, there's a back door. And the back door is that these things are being sold, or were being sold for a long time, in Asian fish markets. In Montreal, I know that I've seen them, in Toronto, in Ottawa. And people were encouraged, I know that because it's happened to me, encouraged to leave with them alive, because they assume you're going to keep it fresh, bathtub or tank or whatever for your restaurant or so on. And I could have, I did an undercover operation in Montreal. I'm not going to name the place I went to, but we found, with one of my students, we took pictures and we got a big head carp. I bought one of these, because I didn't know which one it was. I discovered it was a grass carp. And I could have went into the Port of Montreal and dumped them there if I felt like it. Right? Let's say I believed in getting good karma from releasing fish in captivity, as some people do. It's happening worldwide. And I could have done that. That's the back door. This species is being carried by the aquarium industry. It's outlawed in a couple of provinces now. We've just found out recently, this is hot off the press, that Asian carp DNA have been found in the Great Lakes, actually for the second time, in Lake Michigan and Lake Erie. Lake Erie is relatively far from the Army Corps of Engineers electric barriers, so that means that they have to get in some other way, probably through the back door I talked about. Asian carp are here. We don't know if they're established yet, but I think it's a matter of time. And if they do become established, they will probably be disruptive. The snakehead has already been shown to be capable, based on this model simulation, of colonizing a large part of Canada. And so all it needs is opportunity. Climate change will create opportunities by removing thermal barriers to southern species, especially those from the Mississippi River Basin. Those of you who know your fish, lots of basses and sunfish in the Mississippi River Basin. They're warm water restricted, but that's changing now. Something like this, for example, which has an invasion history, could get into the Great Lakes. These things, red swamp crayfish, are already in the Great Lakes from Mississippi, and they could expand. And this species, Asian clams, which are a subtropical species, probably one of the most successful aquatic invaders in the world, have recently appeared in the St. Lawrence River, downstream of a nuclear power plant. But the power plant has now been shut down. And my students are going to go back and see if these have survived. If they have, we have an interesting situation going on. But they also are established in Lake Erie. So subtropical species, warm water species, being established in the Great Lakes probably are going to become more problematic and spread as a result of climate change. And finally, biological invasions impose significant costs. There was the only study done by colleagues of mine, it's surprising no one has done this before, to add it up. They couldn't find enough data for most of the species, so they looked at 11 well-known ones, and they found that the cost of to our forestry, agriculture, and fisheries is 187 million Canadian per year, and I consider that conservative. The projected future cost of these same species, assuming only 20% resource loss to these industries, is $13 to $34 billion per year. That's the invisible tax. However, I think these costs are underestimated, because the data on most costs, even of the same thing in multiple places on multiple items, are unavailable. And this is only a small fraction of at least 1,400 alien species that are in our forests, agriculture, and aquatic ecosystems. So I think that we've got some quite significant costs here, and we have barely a handle on how much it really adds up to. But globally, here's what we think it adds up globally. In six nations which have relatively good data, $240 billion per year as a result of invasions. That, assuming similar costs worldwide, that translates into the first order estimate of $1.4 trillion per year, which is 5% of the global economic output. That is a big tax. To compare it, the combined direct economic costs of climate-related natural disasters in 2008, when I looked this up, was $200 billion. Now, you get the rare event like Katrina, which will inflate that, but my point is that this may exceed this by an order of magnitude, or nearly so. All right? There's a lot of attention given to these, not so much given to this. Probably because invasions are not considered as a global phenomenon, but as a series of isolated cases. And Norm and I and Michelle Palmer, who got mentioned before, thought it was a good idea to put this in the context of viewing invasions in a different management viewpoint, looking at them as in the same way we look at natural disasters. If, for example, we compare a variety of stressors in terms of the feasibility of control and how much we know about them, natural disasters we know quite a bit, but we can't do much about them, except prepare for the worst as best we can, even for something that may never occur. Other things, we know a lot about them, and we have done something about them. Some things, we don't know much about them at all, but we could do something about them because we're responsible for putting them in the environment in the first place. Where do invasions stack up here? Around here, where we don't have much control when they're released, but we know a fair amount about them, at least enough to know that they're worth trying to control. And I would argue that this was actually Norm's idea originally, that that natural disasters, we treat them for something that may never happen because it would be unacceptable if it did. We use building safety codes, we impose rapid response plans, things that we don't consider for invasions, even though they may cost us more. And if you talk about human life, if those invaders are pathogens, they could cost us as much or more. So I would argue that what we need to create systems of early detection and rapid response, which we can do, and some other countries have done, at national and international scales, we need better risk assessment methods for, we're not trying to control everything. We want to identify the risks in advance of invasion rather than try to put out fires after they've started. Other countries have made headway in this, Australia especially. We should identify and control emerging vectors. Live trade needs to be controlled. It's out of control right now. And we have to tighten regulations concerning trade in live organisms. I don't know how much trouble we're going to have with trade agreements doing this, but I think, reason to believe that we should, because it's going to cost us. And invasive species, unlike pollution, don't degrade, dissipate over time. They proliferate, they adapt, and they spread. So if we think of biological pollution as being something worthy of more, at least as much attention as pollution, then we're certainly not giving it the same attention, and we've been underestimating it for quite a long time. Thank you very much.